labor movement, but it also has to do with the position of immigrants and migrant rights. So a strong commitment to decriminalizing the border, which is a way of strengthening working class actors both within the U.S. and across the border. And it also has to do with significant changes to the nature of our security budget, cutbacks on the security budget, which then mobilize domestic forces around economic needs and show how economic needs, like pressing for a public commitment to health, education, housing, et cetera, are directly tied to the actions of the national security state and have implications for how American corporations and military elites operate abroad.
And very quickly, Daryl, we just have 30 seconds, but we're going to continue this conversation after the broadcast. You speak about the difficulty of what Aziz is saying, because, of course, the left position is determined in part by where you are in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I think solidarity is extremely important. I think it's also true that solidarity is extremely messy. And for people on the left in the West, showing solidarity with people in other parts of the world can be more challenging or less challenging, especially if we're talking about people whose primary oppressors, whose primary concern are geostrategic rivals of the United States. But I think that's all the more reason why it's important to have robust institutions to allow these conversations to happen in the way that Aziz was pointing out.
And we're going to do part two and post it online at democracynow.org. Dara Lee of University of Chicago, as well as Aziz Rana of Cornell. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KABU, meetings will be conducted online via video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify that a meeting is needed.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, a warning about monkeypox.
In the United States, there have been 605 cases in 34 states.
Health authorities tell us which people are most at risk in Oregon. A hearing tomorrow on a case challenging a legal right to die. And a man with terminal cancer is in for yet another fight of his life. And the Oregon town of Mosier is getting a boost with a program that focuses on feeding the hungry. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Thursday, July 7th, 2022. I am Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. A warning about monkeypox. It's a disease that can impact the LGBTQ plus community, according to the Oregon Health Authority. So far, they found at least 6 presumed cases in Oregon, 3 in Lane County, 2 in Washington County, and 1 in Multnomah County. Today, OHA's Dr. Tim Menza said he expects there are a lot more as he gave this update.
As of July 6th, there have been 7,243 cases in 52 countries where HMPXV is not usually reported. In the United States, there have been 605 cases in 34 states plus the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico. In the United States, there have been no pediatric cases and no deaths. In Oregon, as of this morning, there are one confirmed and five presumptive cases. Three of those presumptive cases were identified yesterday. The counties of those cases are Multnomah, Lane, and Washington. Just a distinction, confirmed cases have tested positive for HMPXV at the CDC, while presumptive cases have tested positive for orthopox viruses, which is the broad family of viruses to which HMPXV belongs, at the Oregon State Public Health Laboratory. Thus far, Oregon providers have sent 35 specimens from 20 patients for testing at the Oregon State Public Health Laboratory. Specimens from two patients are currently pending. Typically, HMPXV has an incubation period of 6 to 13 days, but can be as long as 21 days. Illness starts with fever, headache, swollen lymph nodes, muscle aches, and exhaustion. The rash may appear at the same time or 5 days later and generally involves the face, palms and soles, and mouth, and less often the genitals and eyes. The rash can be painful or itchy and moves through predictable stages, including what look like pimples, blisters, and scabs. Illness lasts 2 to 4 weeks, and based on data on the variant currently circulating in non-endemic countries, the case fatality rate is 1 to 3%. But in contrast, in the current global outbreak, the presentation is a bit atypical. The initial flu-like illness can occur, but is sometimes very mild or not present. The location, appearance, and duration of rash are also atypical in that rash is presenting more diffusely and more often on the genitals and around the anus. Sores may also be present inside the mouth, vagina, or anus. The rash can be subtle and may move through typical stages more quickly. This illness presentation has a few implications for the diagnosis of HMPXV. First, people may not readily seek care for evaluation and testing. Second, when they do seek care, most people will likely present to outpatient clinics rather than hospital settings. Third, clinicians may not recognize this more subtle presentation as HMPXV. And finally, the rash of HMPXV may be confused with rashes associated with syphilis, herpes simplex virus, and varicella zoster virus. That said, public health agencies have reported co-infections with chlamydia, syphilis, herpes simplex virus, and varicella zoster virus. HMPXV is transmitted during direct, close, personal, skin-to-skin contact with a person who has symptoms. In addition, contact with towels, clothing, bedding, or other objects used by a person with HMPXV may also transmit the virus. Less commonly, HMPXV may also be transmitted through large respiratory droplets or oral fluids via prolonged face-to-face contact. These types of contact may occur during activities such as sex, cuddling, massage, kissing, talking closely, and/or caring for someone with HMPXV. HMPXV spreads from the time symptoms start when sores, including scabs, have healed with a fresh layer of skin. The genetic material of HMPXV has been found in semen from patients with HMPXV, but it's not yet clear whether functional virus is present in semen, vaginal fluids, or blood that can cause infection. Globally, nationally, and in Oregon, HMPXV was initially associated with travel to non-endemic countries with reported cases. However, more recent cases do not have a history of travel, indicating community transmission within the U.S. and within Oregon. Without intervention, a person with HMPXV will transmit.
Again, that was the Oregon Health Authority's Dr. Tim Menza today. Health experts are again making local masking recommendations as COVID-19 cases surge once more in the ongoing pandemic. Despite Oregon's lower infection status over the last several months, two-thirds of the state's counties are showing another spike in infections of another two substrains of Omicron. Severe symptoms are reportedly mild, though contagiousness remains higher than other strains as the virus continues to morph. Counties recommended for masking include Crook County, with more than 500 cases reported last week. Health officials are recommending indoor masking and other recommended protocols. So far, there are no state mandates on face masking, but it is advised indoors. Six projects that aim to make communities more livable for people of all ages are receiving grants from AARP's Community Challenge Program. One of those projects is in the small town of Mosier, population about 700, in the Columbia River Gorge. Eric Tegedoff talks to a chef involved with Mosier's Community Kitchen Project.
AARP has selected six projects in Oregon to receive funds for its Community Challenge Grant Program. The largest grant, $20,000, is going to a community kitchen project in the city of Mosier, located about halfway between Hood River and the Dalles. Marie Maru is a chef involved with the community kitchen. She notes that about 35% of Mosier's population is age 50 or older.
In the past 2 years, like many communities, Mosier has seen the needs of its citizens increase. One in three people in the Columbia River Gorge are food insecure, and we need community spaces like the Mosier Center.
The plan is to build a community kitchen in the city's community center to provide space to prepare free weekly meals, plus host a food pantry and some commercial uses. Other Community Challenge Grant recipients in Oregon include the city of Woodburn to provide a public gathering space for older residents and a sustainable living center in Salem. Maru says the United States is lacking in public spaces, and so creating them, as with Mosier's community center and kitchen, is invaluable.
It can bring generations together. It can bring people together who might not be able to have conversations surrounding just everyday life. And we hope that the Mosier Center is a place where all people feel welcome to come.
AARP is funding 260 projects across the country through a total of $3.4 million in grants. They selected projects that make cities more livable for people of all ages and that can be completed by November 30th. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
With shootings on the rise in Portland, a local police oversight group is urging the Bureau to incorporate a new technology that could help the city gain control of the escalating violence. The Portland Police Bureau's Focused Intervention Team's Community Oversight Group, or FITCOG, is pushing the city to start using ShotSpotter. It's a technology-based tool currently in use in around 120 cities nationwide. Locally, ShotSpotter technology has been under scrutiny for months, with members of FITCOG even attending conferences in other states to review its process and results. ShotSpotter uses audio sensors strategically placed on buildings, light poles, and other structures to detect and pinpoint gunshots, alerting authorities to precise locations. Despite its reported efficiency, cities using the tool have had some mixed results and actual reductions in gun violence. Chicago residents have commented with local community organizer Andre Miller, with ShotSpotter in place, that it has had little to no impact on reducing gun violence. In a June FITCOG meeting, Miller said ShotSpotter is not actually a deterrent to gun violence, it does not address the root of gun violence, and Chicago is still facing 4 to 5 shootings per day. Recent audits have also noted that ShotSpotter is inefficient at producing viable evidence, has done little to increase investigatory stops, and has been relatively useless in the recovery of gun-related evidence during gun-related investigations. Despite all of that criticism, ShotSpotter may still be a useful tool for de-escalating Portland's gun violence. City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty is showing some support, though she has questions and concerns about its implementation. And other city officials, along with community representatives, agree that current protocols are failing the city's needs. A man from Oceanside, California, who is battling terminal cancer, is also fighting a federal lawsuit that seeks to overturn California's medical aid in dying law. Tomorrow, a federal district court judge will hear arguments in the case. Suzanne Potter has more.
California's aid in dying law could be halted depending on the outcome of a hearing tomorrow in federal court. The Christian Medical and Dental Association is asking the judge to put Senate Bill 380 on hold while the group's lawsuit proceeds. The law allows terminally ill patients with less than 6 months to live to get a prescription to end their suffering if they choose to use it. In Oceanside, 35-year-old Andrew Flack just got his from a pharmacy in case the judge grants a preliminary injunction.
I like having this option because there is a tremendous amount of anxiety that comes with dying from cancer and also the day-to-day pain that you experience. So knowing that I have a way out versus the inevitable suffering, it's relieving.
The plaintiffs argue the law violates their rights by forcing them to tell patients that they don't offer this type of end-of-life care. They must note that in the medical records and transfer the patient's records to another physician upon request. Attorney John Kappos represents Mr. Flack, two doctors, and the Compassion and Choices Action Network, all of whom are interveners in this case.
This is a law that is requiring physicians to do little or nothing more than they're already required to do. So it is not an infringement on First Amendment rights, freedom of religion, freedom of speech. It's more, at most, an incidental impact on those rights.
Dr. Catherine Sonquist-Forrest is a family medicine physician at a UCSF residency in Salinas who treats terminally ill patients and trains other physicians across the Bay Area. Last summer, she says, her husband of 37 years used medical aid in dying when his motor neuron disease became unbearable.
It only takes one personal experience of a beloved or a near family member whose suffering is not answered by hospice or palliative care to understand why that decision needs to be between a person and their care team.
The California Department of Health reports more than 2,800 terminally ill Californians received prescriptions from 2016 to 2020, and about 1,800 individuals chose to use their medication. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
England's leader simply could not survive yet another scandal. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
Great Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced his resignation today. This marks the end of a controversial three-year period when he was in power. The break is not completely clean. Johnson stepped down immediately as leader of his Conservative Party, but said he would remain as Prime Minister until the party picks his successor. The timetable for that process will be announced next week. Candidates for the position include former Health Secretary Sajid Javid, former Treasury Chief Rishi Sunak, Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, and Defense Secretary Ben Wallace. Many others in the UK government have recently resigned. About 50 cabinet secretaries, ministers, and lower-level officials have quit the government over the past few days, several citing the Prime Minister's lack of integrity. The mass resignation stalled some parliamentary committee business because of the lack of ministers. Johnson did pull off Brexit, and was credited with rolling out one of the world's most successful COVID mass vaccination campaigns. But he allegedly maintained ties with party donors said to be too close, protected supporters from bullying and corruption allegations, and lied to Parliament about government office parties that broke COVID-19 lockdown rules. He was fined by police over the parties and survived a no-confidence vote last month in Parliament, in which 41% of Conservative lawmakers attempted to oust him. He called Papua New Guineans cannibals and compared Muslim women wearing veils to letterboxes. Experts feel the straw that broke the camel's back was his support for a lawmaker, Chris Pincher, who admitted to being drunk at a private club in London and allegedly groped two men there. After the latest scandal broke, Johnson still told lawmakers yesterday he had a mandate from voters and intended to continue governing. But he was forced to concede today after one of his closest allies, Treasury Chief Nadim Zahawi, publicly told him to resign for the good of the country. Johnson said, quote, "In the last few days, I tried to persuade my colleagues that it would be eccentric to change governments when we're delivering so much. I regret not to have been successful in those arguments, and of course it's painful not to be able to see through so many ideas and projects myself. It is clearly now the will of the Parliamentary Conservative Party that there should be a new leader of that party, and therefore a new prime minister," end quote. Zahawi was promoted to his new position earlier this week, and he said he and a group of colleagues had privately expressed their concerns to the Prime Minister yesterday. He decided to go public after Johnson ignored the advice to resign. Johnson became Prime Minister in July 2019, succeeding Theresa May, who resigned after Parliament rejected the Brexit argument she negotiated with the European Union. Standing outside No. 10 Downing Street, Johnson added, quote, "Them's the breaks," end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6, it's Rosetti Native Radio. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy this evening with more clouds overnight, a low down to 57. Tomorrow's weather, mostly cloudy skies early, then partly cloudy in the afternoon, a high of 78. today in history. On this date in 1981, President Ronald Reagan appointed Sandra Day O'Connor to become the first female member of the U.S. Supreme Court. Our quote of the day is from Sandra Day O'Connor, who said, "Society as a whole benefits immeasurably from a climate in which all persons, regardless of race or gender, may have the opportunity to earn respect, responsibility, advancement, and remuneration based on ability." An Oregon tribe partners with the state in an effort to reverse declining salmon numbers. Chief Archibald speaks at the AFN annual gathering, and we have new details about Arizona's tuition-free plan. Here's the latest edition of National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In what's described as a historic partnership, the Coquille Tribe and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife have agreed to jointly manage a 5-county area. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
The deal follows a push last year by local governments and groups near the Coquille River to help address drastically reduced numbers of salmon. The campaign urged Governor Kate Brown to back the proposal. John Ogun is a legal representative for the Coquille. He says that effort has paid off in this new partnership.
The governor has sought to implement policies that correct historic injustices to the Oregon tribes as much as possible, or at least in part. You know, there's a sad history with colonialization, settlement, and displacement and disassociation from their cultural values and resources like fish and wildlife, the environment, rivers, and such.
The counties are Coos, Curry, Douglas, Jackson, and Lane, with the possibility other tribes may seek similar agreements with the state of Oregon.
For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
Native leaders have spent much time this week at the annual gathering of the Assembly of First Nations in Vancouver debating the suspension of their national chief. In June, the organization suspended Roseanne Archibald after staff complaints against her. Archibald made history last year, becoming the first woman to lead the powerful Native organization in Canada. She calls the suspension illegal, saying the executive committee does not have the capacity to suspend. During a speech streamed live by APTN National News, Archibald told leaders it's not a human resources issue, but an attempt to silence her because she's trying to clean up corruption within the organization.
The reason we're here today and the reason I'm giving this speech is because I refused to give $1 million plus to staff in a staff payout. I refused. I knew it was wrong. This funding that I am entrusted with is meant to help you, all of your communities, all of your citizens. I can't hand $1 million to four people.
Members of the executive committee maintain the suspension is due to staff complaints and say there's an active investigation. They asked leaders to allow the suspension to continue until the investigation is over, but that motion failed. Instead, leaders are debating a resolution for full reinstatement. During debate Wednesday afternoon, some leaders expressed disgust with the situation, saying it's taking away time, resources, and action from the many important issues facing their communities. Clean drinking water, child welfare, and the Pope's upcoming visit to Canada are among priorities. Leaders are continuing debate on the suspension Thursday, the final day of the gathering. The University of Arizona recently announced it will provide tuition-free education for Native American undergraduates. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, it's part of the university's plan to increase Native student access to higher education.
The program begins in the fall and will cover tuition and mandatory fees for enrolled members of Arizona's 22 federally recognized tribes at the university's main Tucson campus. It applies to new and continuing full-time degree-seeking undergrads in what university officials say is a first-of-its-kind program. University President Robert Robbins says serving indigenous students is a crucial part of U of A's mission, and it'll help hundreds of people access and complete college educations. More than 400 students enrolled at the University of Arizona last year meet the criteria for the tuition waiver. Officials say in the future, the program may expand to graduate students, along with those taking classes online and at other U of A campuses across the state. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The U.S. Supreme Court decision to overturn federal abortion right protections has a strong connection to some religious groups that have long opposed abortion. But there is a wide range of religious beliefs about abortion across the country. As Mike Moen reports, many in the Jewish faith express support for reproductive rights and are voicing their concerns about the court's decision.
In mid-July, several groups will hold an abortion access rally in Minnesota. They include Jewish-led organizations who say much of their community doesn't want to see reproductive rights taken away. Conservative Christians and many of their congregants had long called for the recent dismantling of Roe v. Wade by the U.S. Supreme Court. But Beth Gendler of Minnesota's Jewish Community Action says it's a different tone across Judaism. Pew Research notes 83% of Jews feel abortion should be legal in all or most cases. Gendler says it goes back to early writings from their faith that life begins at birth.
The potential for life that pregnancy affords is, of course, valuable and should be protected. But when it comes right down to it, it really is the life of the person who is pregnant that is paramount.
Opponents from some other faiths believe life begins at conception. Despite the ruling, abortion remains legal in Minnesota, but the coalition behind the upcoming rally wants more access as neighboring states implement bans, forcing more patients to receive care here. And they want some current Minnesota restrictions lifted, such as a 24-hour waiting period. Erica Solomon with the Minnesota section of the National Council of Jewish Women adds their belief system strongly prioritizes standing up for marginalized populations.
This is not just taking care of ourselves and our own, but a commitment to not standing idly by while barriers are placing any individual's autonomy or health or well-being at risk.
And while groups like hers are speaking out, Solomon adds they're not trying to step on the toes of pro-choice activists who have been doing this work for years.
I think we are still trying to find our place in the work while definitely making it our goal to be supporting those that have been leading this fight.
The rally is scheduled for Sunday, July 17th at 11 a.m. in St. Paul. Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection.
The Biden administration defends DACA in court. A South Carolina Republican vows to fight a Georgia subpoena. And the White House announces sweeping changes to the federal student loan program. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2022 Talks.
With locked arms, immigration advocates chanted loudly outside a federal appeals court in New Orleans, where the Biden administration urged justices to overturn a Texas ruling blocking new DACA applications. The Obama-era program prevents the deportation of thousands of people brought into the country as children. Eight states sued, arguing DACA caused additional spending on social service programs. The judge ruled because it provided benefits to recipients without congressional authorization, the program is illegal. Defending the program, New Jersey Attorney General Matthew Plotkin explained DACA recipients are part of the community.
They know only the United States. They live here, they work here, they own businesses here, they're medical professionals, they're employees, they're family members, they're parents, and they represent the best of the United States of America.
Biden administration lawyers argued any costs incurred by states are speculative. A decision is expected in the coming months. South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham is fighting a subpoena from investigators in Fulton County, Georgia, looking into possible criminal interference following the 2020 elections. Graham contends his calls to Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger were about signature verification on mail-in ballots and denies allegations he encouraged him to find enough votes to overturn the election.
I categorically reject that. That wasn't my intent, and that wasn't the purpose of the conversation, to throw out ballots.
Attorney said as chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Graham was well within his rights to discuss election procedures with state officials. Graham is one of seven people subpoenaed by the grand jury. Meanwhile, Raffensperger's office opened an investigation into whether the Democratic Party violated a state statute prohibiting electioneering. At issue is whether a field office is within the legal minimum distance of 150 feet from a nearby polling place. The White House is proposing sweeping changes to the federal student loan system, including a rule to curb interest rates for nearly all of the more than 40 million borrowers. The proposal would also help discharge loans for physically and mentally disabled borrowers and help public service workers earn loan forgiveness. Vice President Kamala Harris called for greater gun control during a visit to Highland Park, Illinois, where a gunman killed seven during a 4th of July parade.
The whole nation should understand and have a level of empathy to understand that this can happen anywhere in any peace-loving community, and we should stand together and speak out about why it's got to stop.
Meanwhile, Harris joined President Joe Biden on a call with Sherelle Greiner, wife of WNBA star Brittany Griner, who has been detained for 140 days in a Russian prison.
I will not be quiet anymore. I will find that balance of, you know, harm versus help in pushing our government to do everything that's possible.
The White House said they are working to free Griner, who is on trial on charges related to possession of cannabis oil. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Climate change is threatening Montana's Glacier National Park. As Eric Tegedov explains, now some businesses are partnering up in an effort to protect their state's outdoors treasures.
Conservation groups aren't the only ones looking to protect Montana. Businesses, too, are joining efforts to preserve the last best place. The Montana Conservation Voters Education Fund's Partners for the Outdoors program has launched to bring companies in the state together to address a variety of issues threatening the environment. That includes development, access to public lands, and climate change. Paul Herndon is with Clearwater Credit Union, based in Missoula. He says protecting the environment helps attract people to work in the state.
One thing that unites the Montana community across all other lines, groups, divisions, is a real love of this place, a love of Montana, a love of the natural environment here. So protecting that environment is important for us in a lot of ways.
Herndon also notes the outdoors is a major economic driver for the state and an important source of jobs. Outdoor recreation supports more than 26,000 jobs in Montana, according to the Outdoor Industry Association. Herndon thinks a clean energy future also is important for Montana. He says the state is well positioned to take advantage of the transition to the 21st century energy economy.
Montana has a great solar resource. We have one of the best wind resources in the country, and we would love to see the state take advantage of that necessary transition and start producing good local jobs, good local tax revenue, and really be a part of that.
Herndon says his credit union is promoting a clean energy infrastructure. It offers loans for solar panels on roofs. Clearwater also is participating in the Commercial Property Assessed Capital Enhancements, or CPACE, program, which spreads out what can be expensive upfront costs for energy efficiency, renewable energy, and water conservation improvements. For Big Sky Connection, I'm Eric Tegedov.